This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When John Irving decided to adapt his novel The Cider House Rolls into a movie, he never expected it would take 13 years. His new memoir, My Movie Business, is about those 13 years and what he learned about the differences between writing books and movies. He didn't write the screenplays for the earlier adaptations of his novels, The World According to Garp and The Hotel New Hampshire. The movie version of The Cider House Rules is set in the 1940s. It stars Michael Caine as Dr. Larch, who runs an orphanage where he also delivers the unwanted babies of women, babies who will remain at the orphanage. And he performs abortions. His apprentice and surrogate son, played by Tobey Maguire, is a young man who grew up in the orphanage and has learned how to deliver babies but won't perform abortions. Here's a scene with Caine and Maguire early in the film.
First pregnancy?
Yes, for both.
I presume you'd prefer handling the delivery?
All I said was, I don't want to perform abortions. I have no argument with you performing them.
You know how to help these women. How can you not feel obligated to help them when they can't get help anywhere else?
One, it's illegal. Two, I didn't ask how to do it. You just showed me.
What else could I have shown you, Homer? The only thing I can teach you is what I know. In any life, you have to be of use.
The Cider House Rules was inspired in part by John Irving's grandfather, Dr. Frederick C. Irving, an obstetrician who graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1910.
He was the chief of staff of the Boston Lying In, which was the country's foremost maternity hospital. He was a professor of obstetrics at Harvard. I know him better through his writing, through his several books on obstetrical and gynecological procedure, than I ever knew him as a kid. I can't recall, in fact, a single intimate conversation with him. He died Christmas Eve when I was 15. So it's through his writing that he made a principal and powerful influence on me. For reasons that are still unclear to me, I was 14 at the time. I felt certain that I wanted to be a writer. It was about the time I started reading Charles Dickens, my earliest fictional hero. And I told my parents I wanted to be a writer when I grew up. And they said, oh, you should read your grandfather's books then. He's a writer. I'm not sure that obstetrical and gynecological procedure was entirely suitable for a 14-year-old.
Yeah, but, what was it like for you at the age of 14?
Riveting.
Were there illustrations of gynecological surgery and of childbirth and things like that?
No illustrations except for the fact that he wrote very descriptive, if Victorian, prose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I learned more about human reproduction from those books than I probably learned in school for, well, maybe ever.
Do you think that reading your grandfather's Victorian language and describing medical procedures affected the way you thought about the body or later wrote about the body?
That's a good question, but I've not thought of it before. I don't know so much that I was affected in that way as that the life of a doctor of medicine at that time, and an obstetrician, gynecologist in particular, was one that I could imagine in full detail. So that in the early 1980s, when I began research for a novel about an orphanage physician and his relationship with an unadoptable orphan, who's born in his orphanage and who is repeatedly unsuccessfully adopted, I had already in mind the kind of detail that I was looking for, the kind of detail that I would find. The surprise, of course, was the abortion subject, because I hadn't set out to write a novel or, in the case of the film of The Cider House Rules, a screenplay that was on or about the abortion subject. It was the relationship of that old physician and orphanage director and this unadoptable kid that I had foremost in mind. But when I began to read the histories of abortion and the histories of orphanage hospitals and the lives of orphanage physicians, that procedure And the life of an orphanage hospital was inseparable, of course, understandably, because if any physician, qualified physician, would take the risk in those days when that procedure was illegal, if any physician would take that risk and perform that procedure, who else but someone who had the sympathy for the condition of those women who came there and left children behind, and more importantly, or just as important, the fact that many of those orphans would not be adopted. The older they got, the less likely it was that anyone would take them, and they would eventually become what at the time was called wards of the state. That made a powerful impression on me, and I decided that the issue of performing that procedure or not performing it would become a crucial area of conflict between the young orphan whom the old physician apprentices, whom he trains to be a doctor, that would be a point of contention between them. Not that the orphan would ever disapprove of the old doctor performing abortions, nor would that orphan believe that women shouldn't have the right to have an abortion if they wanted one. It's just that he didn't want to perform the procedure himself. That is the argument of the story. It is by no means the current political so-called right to life or pro-choice argument. The novel and the film of the Cider House Rules is unequivocally pro-choice.
Now, you say that you were working on the screenplay over a 13-year period and you worked with four different directors. The first director who you wanted to work with on the Cider House Rules passed away. Oh, what about the other two directors who were going to direct it before the final director, Lassie Hallström? Why didn't things work out?
Well, I think that I got to know Wayne Wang, the director that I first tried to work with after Philip Borsos' death. I got to know Wayne so little. We spent so little time together, and we seemed so immediately divided on where the story should go or what the principal story should be, that I can't really tell you why that relationship didn't work, except that it was clear from the beginning that I was listening more to the producer's notes on the script, Richard Gladstein's notes on the script, than I was to the would-be directors. And both Richard and I felt that if the writer is paying more attention to the producer than to the director, if the writer and the producer are seeing the story more eye to eye than the writer and the director, well, that wasn't just a good match. And Wayne had the grace and the intelligence to see that, I think, before I did. I mean, he very politely and said that he just didn't think this was going to work out, and he was right.
And the third director was?
Michael Winterbottom. I loved Michael's film of the Thomas Hardy novel, Jude. I thought that film was sensational, especially as a low-budget film, as it was. The performance he got out of Kate Winslet was amazing. The faithfulness to that novel was just indelible to me. I was very, very impressed. I was impressed that he could do period. I was impressed that he could do sort of sympathy for children. All the things that seemed to me to be integral or essential to making the Cider House Rules, I thought he'd be a good choice. But Michael felt that the romance between the young orphan, Homer, and the girlfriend of the young flyer who first brings the girl to the orphanage for an abortion and then goes off to the war, he felt that that romance was much more central to the story and more important to the story than Richard and I felt it ever should be. We felt that it was important to keep that love story a love affair, to keep it in perspective to the whole. It is one-third of the story of the Cider House Rules, but compared to the relationship between Dr. Larch and his beloved orphan, Homer, and the relationship between Mr. Rose, the black migrant apple picker, and his daughter, Rose, and what that relationship precipitates in Homer. We felt that the love story between Homer and Candy was the small third of the three parts of the story. Winterbottom didn't agree.
My guest is novelist and screenwriter John Irving. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Irving. His new memoir, My Movie Business, is about adapting his novel The Cider House Rules into a movie. As you point out in your memoir, you created a compressed version of the story of The Cider House Rules for the screenplay. And you say the passage of time is so important in your novels, but that's not easily captured in a film. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in how time elapses in a novel as compared to on the screen?
I felt it was essential in taking a long novel and bringing it down to film size. And remember, this is a 2-hour and 5-minute film, short by today's standards. I see a lot of films today that I might have liked if they were half an hour shorter. I felt it was essential that we not indulge the length and the complexity of the material that's in the novel and give ourselves some justification to making a 3-hour movie. I don't like 3-hour movies. I didn't want to see a 3-hour movie. I wanted to see a movie that was even a little short by conventional standards. I think that just works better with an audience. And so the first decisions, the most radical decisions, were what were you going to lose? Who are the characters and their attendant storylines that had to come out of the story whole? Because I feel strongly that if you can't honestly say that a character has the same emotional effect on an audience that that character had on readers, that character shouldn't be in the story to begin with. If you're only going to marginalize that character's emotional effect, lose the character. Those were essential choices and, well, painful ones, but the most radical decisions of what to cut out of the Cider House Rules were made before I'd collaborated with the first of these four directors. They were made when I wrote the first draft of the screenplay. I made them myself.
Is pruning your own novel to make a screenplay a little bit like performing surgery on yourself, you know, that you're too close to it?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a matter of how wholeheartedly or not you believe in the potential of the novel to be a film in the first place. In some cases, I look at my novels and I just don't see the potential film that's there. Or if I do, it seems too much of a compromise at the outset and I'm not interested in it. The thing about the Cider House Rules that made it instantly attractive to me as a potential film, almost from the moment the novel was finished, is that unlike all of my novels, or unlike most of the others of my novels, it was the sixth. I've written 9. I'm finishing a 10th. But it alone has the symmetry that only a journey away from home, which ends up back in the same place, can have. And symmetry is very gratifying in films. It's very gratifying. And it had, in other words, a structure that was instantly visual to me at the outset. I could see that orphan coming back to that orphanage. That was always the end of the story. And I could see it in film terms. I believed in its possibility as a film, which is why I wanted to be involved not only as a screenwriter, but to have approval of the director, to have approval of the cast, to ensure that the director had approval of Final Cut, all those things that writers aren't generally afforded, and which, in the case of other novels of mine made into films, I really haven't been concerned enough to ask.
I think often when a movie viewer has read the book before seeing the movie, they really resent some of the changes that the movie's made. If a character's life is condensed, if the story is condensed, they feel, you know, that the movie has, like, cheated the novel. From your experience, I mean, you realize that there are changes that have to be made in order to accommodate the larger story of the novel into the short amount of time that's covered by, you know, the short amount of time in the movie theater. You write a little bit about Dr. Larch, the doctor at the orphanage, and how you had to kind of pare down some of the characteristics that you'd given him for the book. How did you decide how to change his character, you know, how to alter it for the movie?
I didn't change his character or alter it for the movie. Your first way of putting it is the best. I did tone him down. Lasse additionally toned him down. And brilliantly, I thought, Michael Caine, who played Dr. Larch, also toned the doctor down. In the case of Larch, his dialogue, what he says, is of such a polemical and didactic nature. He is such a moral tyrant in the life of this young orphan. He's right, of course, but he's a tyrant nonetheless. We thought it was essential that we not deviate in the film from what he says in the book. And the truth is that every line of dialogue or voiceover Larch speaks in the film is from some text in the novel. The difference is that the Larch of the novel is a shouter. He's a browbeater. He's a moral bully. And Michael played him much softer, as if he were much more tired out. Your sense of the doctor's ether addiction and its ongoing effect on him, I think, is greater in the film even than it was in the novel. And that's what I would call a soft choice. And I think it was a wise one. I'm happy to see the screenplay being praised as much as it is, but I think that many of Lasse's choices as a director and many of Michael's choices as an actor have made me look better.
Did adapting your novel, The Cider House Rules, into a screenplay lead you to reconsider any of your opinions of your movies that were adapted by other screenwriters?
No, I like those films. I like George Roy Hill's The World According to Garp. I like Tony Richardson's The Hotel New Hampshire. I just felt detached from them. I liked Mark Steven Johnson's Simon Birch, as it was called. I simply didn't think it was close enough to the novel to be called A Prayer for Owen Meany or to use the names of my characters. And Mark and I were in agreement about that from the moment I read his screenplay. I just felt it was too divergent from my novel to use my novel's titles or the names of my characters. Contrary to everything I've read, wherein I'm described as alternately despising the film or whatever, I liked Simon Birch. I just didn't think it should be called A Prayer for Owen Meany, and it wasn't.
In the 13 years that it took to actually get The Cider House Rules to the screen, did you lose interest? Did you ever feel, I'm just really sick of this?
No, you don't lose interest in an experiment as long as you don't change your mind. The experiment was, I've seen films of my novels made other ways, namely by letting them go. Let's see if I don't let one go, how long it takes, and if it'll ever get made. I was prepared at the outset that the film would never be made, but I knew that if it were ever made, it would be made with my approval. And so that was the game. If someone had told me at the beginning it was going to take 14 years, I might not have been so eager to play the game. But once you start, I don't think you can back out. I mean, you've got to be faithful to something and follow through on it. And however long it takes, I intend to do the same thing with The Son of the Circus.
When you're on a plane or a train and you see a passenger reading one of your books, do you introduce yourself?
No. No, I kind of hope I won't be recognized. I wouldn't want to interrupt them from reading the book. They're much better served to be reading the book than they are to be having a conversation with me.
Say they're just carrying the book, and they're not reading it at the moment you see them. Wouldn't say anything?
Well, that would make me cross, yes. I would think, what are you doing instead of reading this book? I had the misfortune once of seeing a woman on a plane back from Los Angeles, actually. I was traveling with my eldest son, and a woman across the aisle, diagonally across the aisle, was reading The World According to Garp, and at some point she closed the book and stuffed it into the air sickness bag in the little envelope in the seat in front of her and never took it out again. And my son was dying to draw her attention to the fact that the man who had offended her so was sitting right across the aisle. So we had a very tense trip all the way to New York, but I was never identified as the culprit who had written the offending passage. Whichever one it is that made her close the book, I'll never know. But it was a highlight. I'll never forget it.
Well, John Irving, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Irving's new memoir, My Movie Business, is about adapting his novel, The Cider House Rules, into a movie. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.